Welcome to your favorite bookish podcast, Fully Booked and Caffeinated. I'm Kelsey.
And I'm Heather.
And today we will be discussing and reviewing The House in the Cerulean Sea by T.J. Klune. That's how you say it, Cerulean, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cerulean, because I listened to the audiobook.
Yeah, that's why I was like, I should check all this stuff with Heather. As usual, let's talk about our fuel for this discussion. What are you drinking, Heather?
Currently, I have H2O because it's 8 p.m. at night, and I should not be drinking coffee at 8 p.m. at night. But today I went to – I actually didn't have coffee today until 2 p.m.
What?
Because I had to go to the dentist, and I don't know. I'm so weird about eating or drinking before I go to the dentist, and my appointment wasn't until 12.
Oh.
Yeah. So I didn't get coffee until 2 p.m.
Okay. But what'd you get?
Which means I went to Dunkin' and I got a cold brew. So, of course, it's not as good in the middle of the afternoon as it is in the morning. But it was all right.
It did the trick.
It did the trick for now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I have an ice cold Cherry Coke Zero. But I text you when I... So I'm moving again. And I had to do recon near my new house, and there's a Dunkin' like right around the corner. So I'm like, okay, let me just check out the Dunkin'. So we already started off on the wrong foot because there's no drive through. But I'm like, that's okay. That's okay. I can get out of the car. Maybe. And then I had to wait a long time to get my coffee, and the coffee was not great. I got my regular butter pecan, you know, cream, whatever. And the ratio was right, but not enough flavor. So it just tasted like cream.
I hate that.
Yeah. And I'm like, I need my butter pecan. That's what I'm here for. But I did get a strawberry filled glazed donut, which I think is new because I've never seen it before.
I've never seen that either. I wonder if it's a location though thing too.
Oh, it might be.
Because I haven't seen that. But sometimes, because there's some Dunkins that don't do French crullers and some that do. So it also might be a location.
They barely
thing.
Had any donuts. Yeah. So I think it was just like they have very few, and then that's probably a special one. It was really good. It was very sweet. But it was a good little treat once in a while.
Yeah, I went to Broad Street yesterday to get us Easter donuts. I got the – it was Devil's Food chocolate donut with Nutella, peanut butter, and something else.
I love Nutella.
But it was really good. And then we got Millie one, her first Broad Street donut. So we got her the Titten Falls, which has the banana glaze on it
because she loves banana. Donuts.
Yeah, and bananas. So – Yeah, so we got her that one. But, like, I couldn't let her eat it by herself because it's so sticky.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, like, with a fork and, like, here you go.
And she just wants to, like, rub it all over her face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, their donuts are so good, though.
I know. So good.
All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
I wish I had a donut right now. That's all right.
I always want a donut.
I know. I would never say no to a donut.
Never.
All right. So... T.J. Klune is actually Travis John Klune, which is the most white boy name I ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in Oregon and was 8 years old when he started writing fiction.
That's wonderful.
I know. And then he moved to fan fiction, which I saw a clip from one of his appearances at a book signing. And he is very passionate about fanfic. He doesn't like that people don't consider that real writing because it has always been a huge outlet for queer kids.
Yeah.
So for the longest time, queer kids didn't see themselves represented in fiction. So these fanfic websites, they were able to insert themselves into these narratives and see others representing the queer community.
Mm-hmm. And they could do headcanons. Mm-hmm. You know, you can create your own. So no, oh my God, I've written my own fanfic. I've read it. Like It is like real writing. It's the point when you're basically copying a story that it gets kind of like rip-off-ish, but creating your own, taking something that's already out in the world and then taking bits and pieces of it and making it into your own, it's still writing.
Of course. And obviously not all of it is going to be amazing writing, but not all books that get published that we've read are amazing writing.
I know.
So that doesn't mean that as a whole it's not real quality writing, you know? Yeah. So I do like that he's so passionate about that. TJ Klune is neurodivergent, asexual, and queer. And nice. He's very open about how this influences his writing. Every one of his stories has queer love. And he actually has a lot more books than I realized. And two series, I believe they're both YA series. One is a queer werewolf series.
Oh, I like
that. And one is a queer superhero series.
Nice.
Doesn't that sound amazing?
Yeah, he's definitely very creative.
Yeah. So I love this representation. I think it's amazing. And he is the appropriate one to tell these stories mm-hmm. because he is queer himself.
Yeah.
Also, on his Goodreads profile, it has where you can list your influences. And his influences are werewolves, people who aren't homophobic dicks, and this one dude named Chuck I met in fifth grade.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah. So he sounds like a funny and likable guy. Stay tuned to the end of the episode where we will be talking about the problematic themes associated with this story and why Book Talk is not a fan of TJ Klune.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear that.
Yeah.
Because then I remember, even mentioned that he might be problematic.
Yes. And so I dove into it. I want to wait until the end so we can discuss the themes on mm-hmm. like a surface level, and then we'll dive in a little deeper.
Okay.
So this book specifically was published in March 2020, which, as we know, is the month that the world ended.
Wow.
Isn't it funny that we'll always have that memory just burned in our brain?
It's like 9/11. Mm-hmm. It's like you know exactly where 100%. You were on 9/11.
Mm-hmm. So it has crazy stats on Goodreads, 4.38 rating, and 8. I like couldn't remember how to say numbers for a second.
Good. Great.
817,389 ratings.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. So many that I didn't know how to say the word. And a sequel, which was just released late last year.
Mm-hmm.
So let me read from the back of my book, because I did have the paperback for this, the book summary. Well, also, before I say that, I just have to say I picked this book because the cover is gorgeous. And also, you know, the little like blurbs from other writers.
Yeah.
The one on the front says, I loved it. It is like being wrapped up in a big gay blanket. Sold me.
That's so true, though.
Say less. Okay. So here is our book summary. Linus Baker is a by-the-book caseworker in the department in charge of magical youth. At 40, he lives in a tiny house with a devious cat and his old records for company, but his quiet life is about to change. Linus is summoned by extremely upper management and given a curious and highly classified assignment: travel to an orphanage on a distant island and determine whether 6 dangerous magical children are so dangerous, in fact, that they're likely to bring about the end of days. When Linus arrives at that strangest of islands, he's greeted by a series of mysterious figures, the greatest mystery of which is Arthur Parnassus, the master of the orphanage. As Linus and Arthur grow closer, Linus discovers the master would do anything to keep the children safe, even if it means the world has to burn, or worse, his secret comes to light. The House in the Cerulean Sea is an enchanting love story, masterfully told, about the profound experience of discovering an unlikely family in an unexpected place and realizing that family is yours. Love.
Mm-hmm.
I love the little Easter eggs. The world has to burn. A burning secret.
Oh, I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, because we'll get to the fire. Anyway. Okay, so as we heard, we start with our main character, Linus, who works as a caseworker for the Department in Charge of Magical Youth, aka Dichomy. So Linus is an unlucky guy. He doesn't have any friends. He's lonely and anxious and feels like a failure at 40 years old. But he does pride himself on being very effective at his job. He is going through the motions one day at his very soul-sucking desk job mm-hmm. that he's been working at for 17 years. And he gets summoned to a meeting with extremely upper management, which is concerning and surprising because basically Linus spends every moment trying to blend in and stick to the rules and not be seen. So this mm-hmm. is alarming that he's being called out by extremely upper management. So at the meeting with them, which is basically like being in court in the Harry Potter books.
Yeah.
Where they're all like high above and looking down, like spotlight style, and it's kind of terrifying. Linus gets a mandatory, very secretive, and classified assignment to spend a month on an island with six magical children and report everything he sees. He's to spare no detail. And he basically gets no other information. They're like, okay, you leave tomorrow for a month. Bye. And he's like, but, and they're like, no questions. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Linus just kind of goes with it because he's terrified of getting in trouble, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
So getting to the island is quite the adventure. And as most of these stories have, he meets a cranky woman at the train station who is going to take him to the island.
Mm-hmm.
And Linus is just panicking because he's so used to his little bubble and his routine. And he's never been away. He's never even seen the ocean. So he's terrified, but he's also in awe,
mm-hmm.
like of just how beautiful and different. And
well, even like when he was traveling to the island, it rained every single day where he lived.
Mm-hmm. So I'm like, now, is he in Seattle or something? It sounds, I know, horrible.
It's like literally like what I thought. I was like, this guy's like living in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So then when he goes to Marcius Island and it's like this, he sees the ocean and like that's kind of like been his dream.
And he smells it and hears it and he just can't believe it. So the cranky woman is Zoe Chapelwhite, and he knows there's something up with her, but he can't quite figure it out. Plus, there's other things to worry about. So when they get to the house, which is on an island that they have to take a ferry to, and it's the only thing on this island and a bunch of like woods. So when they get to the house, Linus is kind of thrown to the wolves, mm-hmm. and he meets all of the children without any sighting of the head of the orphanage. First, he meets Talia, a garden gnome.
Obsessed.
With a beard and everything.
I loved her so much.
Oh. And she is very protective of her garden.
And very sassy.
Oh, the sassiest. She's got a hard exterior with lots of death threats.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get past that, she's very trusting and she has a huge heart.
Mm-hmm.
And she warms up to Linus first.
Yeah.
She really finds herself always gravitating towards mm-hmm. him and like holding his hand. And oh, it's so cute. Next, there's Fee, who is a forest sprite, which is kind of like, I kind of got like a wood nymph vibe.
I did too. Yeah.
So she listens to nature and communicates with the earth, and she can grow trees and flowers in seconds. And she says it's by talking to the earth and basically letting the earth know that it can trust her intentions, mm-hmm. and then it gives her what she asks for because it trusts her.
Yeah.
Which is like so cool. I wish they kind of dove into that a little bit more.
Yeah, I feel like she was one of the characters that wasn't as prevalent as mm-hmm. the other kids. So I'm hoping that maybe her arc in the second book is a little bit more.
Yeah, and it's weird because her and Zoe were kind of like this pair.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't dive into either of them too much, but it also goes with like the sprite, like they're supposed to be very private and
yeah.
But I would like to hear more about her. So then there's Sal, who is a young teenage boy who turns into a Pomeranian when he's scared. Just poof. But it's not all cute fluffy puppies. It's like a werewolf situation. So if he bites someone, mm-hmm. they'll also turn into a weredog. I don't know what he's called.
I don't even know. Kind of like a shapeshifter almost.
Yeah. But specifically into a Pomeranian. So he's very skittish and he immediately turns into a dog when he sees Linus. And Linus is like, I mean, reminder, Linus is not a magical creature. He has no powers. So he is seeing all of this and he's like some of these obviously he knew about sprites and garden gnomes, but it's not something he sees on a daily basis. And mm-hmm. it's kind of something that he knows more in theory than actually in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have Chauncey. And Chauncey is like a big blob worm with eyes on tentacles. And he just has like a lot of slimy tentacles and he's kind of like see-through a little bit.
The narrator does Chauncey in this wonderful, lispy, weird voice. And it just like makes me love him that much more. So when you do the audio for the second, like you'll hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Little bellhop Chauncey.
Obsessed. I love Chauncey. So, as you said, his dream is to be a bellhop.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told for his whole life before coming to the island that he's some scary monster that people should be terrified of. So sometimes he hides under the bed because mm-hmm. he thinks that monsters belong under the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this whole, I mean, we can get into it later, but it's this whole thing about like Chauncey's dream is to be a bellhop, which to anyone else is like such a low dream. Like the bar is low.
Yeah.
But for him, the bar is low because that is the only way that he could see himself actually being able to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Like he sees that as this amazing, helpful position where not only is he like helping people with their bags, but he's welcoming them. He's the first person they see when they are on vacation or when they get to this, you know, this beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far as his aspirations could ever go in his mind.
I know.
So he practices taking Linus's bags and doing his laundry, and he demands a tip for his great service every time. Uh-huh. As he should.
As he should.
He's about that bag.
Yeah, he is.
And Theodore is a wyvern. Yes.
Yes, wyvern. Yes.
Wyvern. Mm-hmm. Which is basically like a bird / bat / dinosaur. He says he's about the size of his cat.
Yeah.
But giant wings. So if he walks, he trips over his wings mm-hmm. and gets all turned around. So mm-hmm. he prefers to fly. He chirps in his own little language, and he has a hoard where he keeps treasures, including a bunch of buttons from Linus.
Mm-hmm.
And he has, we find out later that in his hoard, he has a little something from all of the other kids.
Yeah.
And then the real reason that Linus is shitting his pants is our final child, Lucy, a.k.a. Lucifer, the son of the devil and the literal Antichrist.
Yes.
I want to go get another animal so that I can name it Lucy, a.k.a. Lucifer.
You definitely should do that.
Like, are we kidding? I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I was shooketh when we heard about Lucy. Not expecting Antichrist to be in this book.
I know. But it's like, it's a completely different perspective of the Antichrist, like completely. Mm-hmm. And I think if I had read his part instead of doing the audio, it would have been a little bit, I would have seen it differently too. But because just listening to the narrator do like this little kid voice for mm-hmm. Lucifer is like so funny.
Yeah, we'll get to it, but I love Lucy. So basically he receives the worst of the bias because
he's Lucifer.
He's the Antichrist. But he has this amazing attitude and he makes jokes and he scares Linus to death at every opportunity by threatening to boil his insides mm-hmm. or to bring about the end of the world. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, he's still a 6-year-old boy mm-hmm. who is trying to grow up.
Yeah.
So now all these children have crazy backgrounds and stories, and basically this is the last possible chance for them. This is the end of the road. They've had chances at other places, and they were cast out to this island as kind of a last resort. And we don't know what would actually happen to them if they left this island, but mm-hmm. we know it wouldn't be good.
Mm-mm.
So the worst of which is Sal, who has moved something like 10 times.
Yeah, which is like heartbreaking.
It's horrible. His character
too is like this little, I mean, not little, but he's like, you know, this teenage boy who truly has a good heart, and he's just so misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. And he wants so badly to be able to open up and to be mm-hmm. able to trust. And the fact that he still can after all that he's been through just shows like how resilient kids are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's never stayed anywhere long. He's a typical worst case scenario foster kid. Like,
yeah, 100%.
He's super jumpy. He's super skittish. He takes a while to trust anyone. And he's only been with Arthur for a short time. And he already trusts Arthur and the other kids as much as he can.
Yes.
In his position. But he also isn't comfortable. Like, he is not convinced that he gets to stay.
Yeah.
Because he's never had a place that he was able to stay.
Exactly. He kind of counts his days.
Mm-hmm. So Ms. Chapelwhite, I already said her. Yeah, okay. Ms. Chapelwhite, the cranky caretaker, kind of, is also a sprite. And Linus is shocked by this because she's unregistered, which I don't love the implications of. But it takes him by surprise because, of course, all magical creatures have to be registered with the government.
Mm-hmm.
And sprites are like 500 years old or something crazy. And
yeah,
this whole island is hers. Mm-hmm. And she has. And so sprites are very protective and very possessive.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that she's even letting them. Well, this is what Linus has heard about sprites.
Yeah.
So the fact that she's even letting them live there on the island, he's surprised mm-hmm. by, because he's never heard of a generous sprite.
No.
So, because like we said, all of his knowledge comes from the book version of what these yeah. kids should be, not mm-hmm. what they actually are. Okay, so then we have Arthur, who is the master of the orphanage. Don't like that word either, but he is a sweet middle-aged man who sounds very grandfatherly sometimes, but also kind of hip.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't exactly picture him as much as I wanted to.
Okay.
What were you picturing for him?
Kind of like a middle-aged English dude.
Yes. With like the tight pants and the socks always showing. And I could picture him like wearing a vest and a bow tie.
Yes.
Yeah. Like just for funsies.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. But he also has like a white beard, right?
I don't remember.
I might have made that up.
I actually don't know what his facial hair situation is.
Yeah, I didn't take notes on his facial hair. Weird. So anyway, he's ridiculously sweet. And immediately you know that he has the kids' best interests in mind. And he teaches them life lessons at every single opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every opportunity. And you can see that the kids respect Arthur so much. And that they just respond so well to him. Like, he mm-hmm. knows how to communicate with each of them. Because they are so, I mean, they're kids. They're all different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So basically, Linus's job is to observe how things are going at the orphanage and at the end of a month to make a recommendation as to whether the orphanage should remain open and whether Arthur is taking care of the children properly. So he observes the children in their lessons and at meals and during their recreational time, where Chauncey practices his bell hopping in the mirror. Sal writes poetry on an old typewriter. Talia gardens. Fee practices with Zoe, learning about sprite things. Theodore admires his hoard. And Lucy listens to records.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucy and Linus really bond. I mean, Linus is absolutely terrified of Lucy, which, like,
oh,
understandable.
Yeah.
But also, how could you not love this kid?
I know.
And they bond over their love of music, because mm-hmm. Linus also, like, he, in his home life, he is extremely lonely, and the only thing he really does for himself, or I don't even know if I could say for fun, but recreationally is listen to records.
Yeah.
And he kind of like dances around his house by himself and he just loves music. And so it really breaks the ice between him and Lucy.
I agree.
And he sees, he obviously has this not that much of a preconceived notion about Lucy because like he hasn't even really let himself think mm-hmm. about it too much, but he automatically thinks that it's bad, you know? Mm-hmm. And when he sees Lucy in the kitchen helping with dinner and mm-hmm. belting out music and dancing around and just like acting like a kid, he is so surprised.
Yeah.
Because his very regimented attitude and his very by the books attitude doesn't allow him to think of these kids as more than just mm-hmm. his assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because he's not like, when you just say it like that, it makes him sound so heartless.
Yeah.
And he's not heartless, mm-mm. but he is way too trusting in the system.
Well, no. And like there, and it's so, he's so by the book, literally, with like, you know, he reads the rules and regulations for fun over and over again. So you kind of get the idea that he's just this very strict professional guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that, because even when he was working at Dykeme, you know, he would say that he wouldn't, he kind of prided his 17 years of never having any demerits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, like, he always just tries to do what he's supposed to do. And so, like, yeah, coming into this kind of atmosphere is not what he's used to.
Mm-hmm. And he, when I say he's trusting in the system, he thinks that as long as he does his job mm-hmm. and he, you know, writes the things he's supposed to write and does the recommendations and checks the boxes that he's supposed to check, then whoever his case gets handed off to, once his job is done, that they're handling their part properly. And then those kids are going to be taken care of because that's the way the chain of command should work.
Mm-hmm.
So to him, people are like, well, whatever happened to the kids at orphanages that you recommend should be shut down? He's like, well, I don't know. That's not my responsibility. That's for the supervisors. That's for, and he's not saying it in like a, not my job, not my problem. He's saying it in like, no, this is my job. Everyone has their own job. I'm good at my job.
Yeah.
I do my part. Mm-hmm. And then someone else has to make sure that the next step is done because I got to worry about my next case.
Exactly.
So it sounds heartless, and in a way it kind of is, but it's more because of his view on work, not because of his view of the kids.
No, and like he's very also, what's the word I'm looking for? Cognizant that he won't have any sort of bias
mm-hmm.
towards the kids, and he doesn't try to get emotionally attached to any of the kids that he surveys in the orphanages. You know, this is like the first case that he's had where he's had to like kind of go on like a holiday for it. Mm-hmm. Like he has to go for 4 weeks. He's never typically in a house that long.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a completely new territory for him.
Yeah. And
like all the things that he does normally kind of gets thrown out the window because it mm-hmm. just doesn't work in this
situation. Well, he's so used to being alone. And they're like, no, you're going to have all your meals with us. Uh-huh. And also, extremely upper management, when he had that meeting with them, basically they tell him the reason we are picking you is because we've read your reports and we see how detailed, we see how you're not biased, we see how you stick to the rules and regulations and you don't let
mm-hmm.
your feelings cloud your judgment. And because this is such a precarious situation and a complex situation, they need someone who's going to remain objective.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how we got off on that tangent, but that's that. So the villagers, who are just a ferry ride away, think that the children are evil and dangerous, and they are actually paid by the government for their silence, which is baffling and icky. But needless to say, the children don't go to the village ever.
No.
And Linus is concerned, you know, because now he's been there for long enough that he sees that Arthur is taking great care of the kids, that he's giving them everything they need as far as, you know, their recreational time and their lessons and their they're a little bit of independence. They're bonding with each other, but he's like, how are these kids ever going to grow up and leave the orphanage? They can't live here forever. And how can they be successful if they've never even been off the island? Mm-hmm. And to Arthur's credit, like, this is obviously to protect them because he doesn't want them to see how the villagers perceive them.
Yeah.
Because they're just kids. Like, that's, it's going to hurt their feelings. It's going to affect them. Mm-hmm. So he is just trying to be protective, but then, you know, he kind of starts to see things from Linus's perspective, and he sees that Linus is connecting with the children, mm-hmm. and he sees that he's finally opening up to Lucy, and mm-hmm. that him and Talia have this, like, great mm-hmm. little banter back and forth, and he's just really, he knows that Linus now cares about their well-being also.
Yes.
So he thinks, okay, let's try and take them to the village. Let's see how it goes.
Yes.
And this is the most entertaining part of the book because they split into pairs with a chaperone.
Yeah.
And of course, Linus is paired with Lucy and Talia.
Mm-hmm.
And who are absolute troublemakers, and they feed off of each other.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
So they go to a gardening store, and Talia picks out a bunch of new gardening tools, and aka weapons, and Linus buys them for her.
I know.
Which was so effing cute.
And then her, like, hug on his leg.
I was I can't.
Dying.
I actually can't. And then you just picture her as this adorable little garden.
I know.
Mm-hmm. So while they're there, Talia also bonds with Helen. And I just love Talia so much because she doesn't care that she is different. She doesn't care about people's opinions. She knows about her garden and she's damn well going to talk about her mm-hmm. garden.
Yeah.
So she bonds with Helen, who's the owner of the gardening store, and they talk in depth about gardens, and Helen asks if she can come and see Talia's garden, and it's just a very unexpected encounter. And then as they're, well, I think this actually happens at the record store, but regardless, Talia sees a little girl through the window.
Yeah, the record store.
Yeah, and the little girl is, like, making faces at her and, like, laughing with her. She says she likes her hat. And then the girl's mom comes over and, like, rips her away. And she's like, how dare you talk to my child? And, and you know, Linus is like, uh-oh, that was so horrible. And Talia's just like, yeah, that mom was, like, kind of mean, but the little girl was cute and, like, you know, that's just one person.
Yeah.
And not everyone is going to like me, but if I can just get one person, that's a good start. And she just has, like, this amazing positive outlook.
She has a lot of wisdom, which I think makes sense because she's a gnome. I feel
like she's like 270 years old or something.
Yeah, but I feel like gnomes are kind of like the archetype for them is that, like, they're full of wisdom, like little Keebler elves.
Yeah.
You know?
So then they go to the record store for Lucy and wow.
Oh my God.
So there's, like, this stoner sales associate who's, like, bonding with Lucy. And then they go in the back to get more records and they hear Linus hears a big kerfuffle and he's like, what the hell's going on? So he goes into this back room and Marty, another one of the sales associates, is on the ground, completely knocked out. The plaster on the wall is, like, cracked. And Lucy is just, like, chilling, looking through the records. And what's his name? J-Bone?
Yeah, something like that.
And
J-Bone
is like, not cool, man. And at first you think he's talking to Lucy, but he's talking to unconscious Marty.
I know.
So basically what happened is Marty cornered Lucy in this little back room and tried to brandish a cross at him
felt very much like the power of Christ compels you was, like, all that kept going through my head.
And it's so funny because Lucy is just like, imagine he thought that was that would work. I was gonna set it on fire, but I thought that would be a little much. And he's just so funny. Mm-hmm. And then J-Bone is like, that was not cool, man. Like, he's just here trying to look at music. He wasn't trying to hurt you, you know. So he's obviously on Lucy's side. And Linus is like, oh my God, like, he just committed a felony, but it's fine. And they end up leaving the record store and everything is fine somehow. Mm-hmm. And then they go to get ice cream and they have just an awful run-in with one of the townspeople. Mm-hmm. And he's a real piece of shit and he doesn't want to serve them and blah, blah, blah. And it sucks because, like, they're having this amazing day.
I know.
And this is supposed to be, like, the perfect ending. Mm-hmm. You know, Sal gets scared and he turns into a Pomeranian. And Helen storms over from the garden store. She calls out Norman, or whatever the fuck his name is, the ice cream store guy, and tells him to get out of there. And then she serves them their ice cream. Mm-hmm. And, like I said, luckily these kids are so damn resilient because 5 minutes later, they're fine. Yeah. They're eating their ice cream. They could care less. And you knew that the day wasn't going to be perfect.
Yeah.
So Linus is obviously growing more and more fond of every child, because how could you not? And he's fiercely protective of them. He has some feelings for Arthur that he refuses to acknowledge and still tries to convince himself that he's being objective.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely this tension between Arthur and Linus, sexual tension, but also tension because Arthur is trying to be so patient.
Yeah.
And he gets, you know, like a little snippy with Linus, and Linus says words incorrectly, and they kind of bicker a little bit, but then you can see that Arthur really sees underneath all of that shit with Linus and sees that he's this great person that's just kind of been influenced by society like everyone else who's scared of these children.
Yeah.
But he sees that the children are changing that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of he's like, okay, now you're seeing what I see, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, meanwhile, Linus is still sending weekly reports to Dykeme, calling them out for not preparing him adequately or warning him.
Yeah.
And Dykeme responds by planting some seeds of doubt with Linus and insinuating that he's being used or manipulated by Arthur and Zoe. Linus spirals, and when he's given a file on Arthur and a key to a secret cellar, he has to investigate because he realizes he would be devastated if he was wrong about Arthur. Yeah. And he knows that Arthur isn't really being fully honest with him, so he doesn't feel like he could just ask him outright.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that Arthur is a phoenix, the last of his kind, and he was tortured and trapped in the cellar when he was a child in the same orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a whole thing. He was in there for a while, and then a caseworker finally came to check out the orphanage and found him, and it was just very horrible. And as he got older, he decided to come back and make his hell into a sanctuary for other magical kids.
Mm-hmm.
So he approached Dykeme with the proposal, and they agreed because it meant they would still have the upper hand. They could keep an eye on Arthur because they did not trust him, and also have a place to send the most dangerous magical kids that they didn't know what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, a day and a half before Linus is scheduled to leave, the villagers decide to form an angry mob, and they want the children to leave their vicinity because they're a threat just by existing.
Yeah.
And it's the saddest, most pathetic mob.
Oh, yeah. I know.
And they really don't have a leg to stand on.
No.
And I have mixed feelings about Helen, but I love her during this mob scene where Marty, the kid from the record store, is her nephew, and he's got a fake neck brace on, and she's like, that's my neck brace, it was in my closet. He's like, no. And she's like, it has my initials on it, everyone can see it.
Uh-huh.
And it's just so funny that she like drags him away by his ear. But anyway, so as most mob, they don't have a leg to stand on once Linus starts asking them why they're really there and like confronting them. And as most mobs do, someone decides to get violent and throw a rock.
Yeah.
And Arthur, being the protective Daddy Warbucks that he is, protects his flock. So he turns into a beautiful, majestic phoenix and scares the shit out of the villagers.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the end of that.
Uh-huh.
It's almost anticlimactic. I mean, that is the climax and it's amazing, but the mob is almost anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Like, they were never going to hurt anyone.
No, that was probably the weakest part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I did really love how, like, how hard Linus was riding for them and everything.
Yeah, that part is definitely necessary. And obviously, Arthur had to have his big reveal, but it should have been bigger stakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's also hard because the whole book is written in this kind of whimsical, joking, bantery way.
Yeah.
And I think that was a little too much in the mob scene when it should have been a little more serious.
Yeah.
So, of course, we know that we're going to get to the day where Linus has to leave. And Arthur asks him to stay, flat out. And Linus refuses because life has to continue on. And because he's stubborn and he's scared.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time you're like, is he going to get on the train? Oh, is he going to get on the bus? Like, you're just waiting for him to turn his little tush around and get back to Arthur and the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, when is it happening? But turns out he needs to take care of business first.
Yeah, he has a whole, this whole plan.
He's got to take care of things. He can't just stay. He's got to wrap things up at home.
Mm-hmm.
So he finishes his final report. He turns it in to Extremely Upper Management and has a final meeting with them. And all his final reports, all of his other final reports have been like 10 pages long.
Yeah.
But his final, final report has one sentence and it says, it is my recommendation that the orphanage remain open under the care of Arthur. And they're like, are you sure that's it? And he's like, yep. And then he kind of absolutely loses his mind and pops off on Extremely Upper Management. And they're like, you better keep your mouth shut. And he's like, no. And then finally he's like, and then he kind of like wears himself out and then they dismiss him. And he's just like, goes back to work as usual, waiting to get fired. So he starts stealing case files. He quits his job immediately after he receives approval on his case from Extremely Upper Management. He goes back to Arthur and begs to be let back in, and they let him off the hook pretty damn easily.
Yeah.
Which I'm not surprised because they all knew that he was coming back.
Yeah. They just didn't know when or how.
Yeah. He made them wait a little too long. This was like a few weeks.
Exactly.
So Arthur and Linus send anonymous tips to the Dichomy, which sparks an investigation into the prejudices in orphanages, and they are in the process of trying to adopt all of the children.
Mm-hmm.
And we end the story with Helen, the mayor of Marcius. Okay.
Marcius Island.
Okay. Who has been instrumental in helping them since Linus came with, like, bridge the gap between them and the villagers. And she's basically the only one really on their side.
Yeah.
And luckily the villagers respect her and listen to her. And she's got a lot of pull with them. And she kind of, you know, she says that she feels horrible that she let it go on for as long as it did. But she got complacent and she kind of fell into the norm of just, you know, out of sight, out of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so she apologizes for that. And then, you know, Linus coming kind of shook things up and she got motivated again. So she comes and tells them that a new child needs a home. And he's a Yeti.
Oh, my God.
A Yeti named David.
I can't.
And Arthur sneakily proposes marriage to Linus. And that's the end.
Uh-huh.
So they're setting us up for the sequel nicely.
Yeah, they definitely are. Linus's insistence on, like, immediately, like, adopting David or, like, bringing him into the family.
Mm-hmm.
He had, like, no qualms whatsoever.
Yeah, he's like, how soon can we get him? Can we get him today? Can we get him today? And he's like, where will he be warm? I mean, where will he be comfortable? Because he likes the cold. And He's just fully bought into his new life. Okay, so let's get into a few things to discuss. Who is your favorite child and why?
I know.
You can't pick a favorite. I know. Okay, let me...
I think Chauncey.
Okay.
I think I really just like Chauncey because he's kind of misunderstood and he just has this want to help people. And I think because I love his audio and like how he's presented in the book by the narrator as well, I think just makes him that much more likable.
I don't know if I could pick a favorite. I would probably, like, at first I would say Chauncey, but then I'm like, but Lucy and Sal. Let me ask this question. Which child did you relate to the most?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I relate to Talia because I am also cranky and bristly until you get to know me. But once you do, I'm fiercely loyal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very on, and sassy. On point. I guess for me it would probably be Sal. Because he hides because he doesn't like confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very like introspective and mature. And really cares about people.
Mm-hmm. I could see that.
Yeah. Because I really liked him, too. And his, like, creative side.
And how he really opens up to Linus. Uh-huh. And
because I feel like he gets screwed over so many times, but he's still able to, like, find trust in people as well.
And they say this a bunch of times throughout the book, you know, because he was sent there because he did bite a woman who had physically abused him. And, you know, he had put up with all of this stuff for so long and been kicked down and kicked down. And, you know, they keep saying, like, you can kick a dog a million times and then that million and one time, like, they're going to fight back.
Yeah.
And it really, I mean, it's horrible to compare him to a dog, but it is that survival instinct.
Yeah, exactly. But that's like the whole point, I think.
What did you think of Linus's story arc?
It was really, really interesting in that he is kind of like this by the book man who has no relationships with anybody, lives by himself with his cat, who didn't even really warm up to him until they came to Marcia's Island. Yeah, and, you know, he's very much, like, they just keep, like, digging in about how he just reads the rules and regulations all the time, and his reports are always perfect, and he never allows himself to get emotionally attached to anyone. And then he's, like, thrown onto this island with all these chaotic children, and he kind of has no choice but to get emotionally attached, or at least look at things differently compared to what he was doing pre the island. And like, he ends up being this really lovable guy who loves these children like so much, and you know, just like wants the best for them.
I completely agree. And then there's even on a smaller scale, he finds his voice and he is able to stand up for not only these kids that he's become so protective over, but also for himself. And, you know, he realizes that he doesn't have to continue with this life or continue to be unhappy when he could just take things into his own hands. Yeah, so I just like that. Not only did he discover, but he also grew in himself
too. He did. Like, he really came into his own because he finally found, it's like a found family.
Oh, 100%. You know,
like, because he didn't have anybody. And so, like, now he's in this situation where, and he's kind of, like, surprised by how welcoming everyone is. Like you said before, like, Zoe is the island sprite. And so he knows how meaningful it is and how rare it is to be invited in. So like when they're doing their like a little explorer adventure thing, which I loved so freaking much, and like they go to like Zoe's habitat And she, you know, Linus doesn't go inside because, like, he wasn't invited. And then when Zoe's like, what are you doing? Like, you know, and she invites him in. He's, like, all of a sudden, like, kind of taken aback by the fact that she's being so welcoming. And, like,
flattered.
Yeah, like, he's like, wow, like, this is a really big deal. Like, because, like you said, like, he may not have ever really met a sprite, but, like, he knows he's done enough research to know, like, their characteristics and, like, who and what they are, so.
And it's also crazy to see, I mean, and Arthur says it to Linus a few times, like, you don't see who you are. You don't see what you're capable of.
Yeah.
Because Linus ends up helping every single one of those kids, Sal especially.
I know. I think, like, his relationship with Sal is probably my favorite one.
And also, I mean, he does it with everyone. Like, you see it with Talia, with Lucy. Not so much with Fee, like we said. They do have a little bit. But also, they do have that really sweet moment with the sunflower.
Yes.
Which is beautiful. But he really says the right thing to these kids. And Arthur is so happy because he's like, yeah, of course they trust me and they listen to me. But they need to hear from someone else, too. Yeah, especially someone who is brand new and doesn't know them. Like, so they see an outsider helping them with their independence and with this, that, and the third. Like, he says these off the cuff things to each of the kids that end up helping them so much.
They really do.
Okay. So do you like the way he went about his final report?
Yeah. The, like, soapbox at the end about every single child and him, like, putting these extremely upper management stick-up-their-asses people in their place. And, like, saying, like, you know, because it's kind of like, it's just, it's so relevant to real life because if a kid is different, they're just kind of treated differently and not, like, taken seriously, and especially in the climate of this past week. And, you know, the whole thing with autism and autistic people. And it's just like, just because someone is neurodivergent and different, this is, it's kind of the equivalent of that with, like, the magical creatures. Like, they're not something to be feared. And they're not something to be hidden and put away. Like, they deserve to have a voice and to be heard and try to live a life as normal as they possibly can. So it's really inspiring, that entire scene. Like,
and it's also, it really shows that these kids are more than you think they are. I agree. I also loved that in his final report, you know, and in all his other reports, he's writing paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs, and he's usually a man of so many words. And at the end, you know, he's struggling and he's like, I don't know how to express that I feel like the orphanage is great and Arthur is great. And he kind of already knows that no matter what he says, they already have their own opinion.
Yeah.
So he's like, you know what? I'm just going to keep it to the point and say what I have to say. And that's so unlike him. And it gets the message across loud and clear.
Yeah. 100%.
So as you mentioned, there's this huge theme of found family. Since Linus was so isolated and lonely, and he found somewhere that he belonged to fully. And there's this quote from Helen that I want to read. A home isn't always the house we live in. It's also the people we choose to surround ourselves with. You may not live on the island, but you can't tell me it's not your home. Your bubble has been popped. Why would you allow it to grow around you again?
Yeah, I remember that.
And it's just so, I mean, I knew that this was about found family, but it's about so much more than that. And just about, like, how having that family around you can give you confidence and not just love and security, but also confidence and motivation and determination and all of these other things.
Yeah, it just changes you as a person.
Yeah.
Because now you're in a situation where you can, like, finally be yourself or, like, and, you know, really discover who you are. Because when you're kind of, like, put into a box that you think you belong in and no one's telling you different, you're never really going to try to expand.
As why would you?
You're exactly.
He was so comfortable just going through the motions of life.
Yeah. And, like, he knew he was unhappy, but, like, he accepted it?
Yeah. He didn't see a way out of that.
Yeah.
Because he was so deep into mm-hmm. it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he really should have bitch slapped his next door neighbor before he moved. Oh. That's all I want to say.
Oh, my God. They did, in the audio, like, a raggedy chain like smoking smokes. Voice.
Yeah, oh, that's exactly what I was and thinking.
And she
yep.
just pissed me off so, so much. Like, ugh. Oh my God, her character was so grating.
Yeah, yeah. All right, is there anything else you want to discuss before we move on to less happy topics?
I think the only scene that really touched me that, like, I really, really loved was when Lucy had a nightmare and, like, Lioness came in and Lucy was so trusting with Lioness, like, immediately. And then when he says, like, when he moved in, he's like, you have to promise that every time I have a nightmare that, like, you're there. And it's like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just his connection with the kids. They were all so different, but so meaningful.
Mm-hmm. And he knew that Lioness saw something that would influence his decision mm-hmm. about the other kid's safety and yeah. about Lucy's safety. Yep. And in that moment, he still turned to Lioness for comfort.
Yeah.
And Lioness handled it so well. Yeah. And he saw how powerful Arthur was in that moment and also just how small and innocent Lucy yeah. was.
Like, he has such this stigma against him that Lioness obviously fell for and believed in and
mm-hmm.
was very – had definitely a very clouded judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But now that he, like, knows him, you just – like, you do. You realize that you're not your name.
Mm-hmm. Even if you try to convince everyone that you are with your empty threats.
Mm-hmm.
I should have written down some of my favorite threats because there were some good ones.
So many good ones.
Okay. So let's get into the controversy. So I did a lot of TikTok diving. So before I get into the big thing, I saw this creator on TikTok saying that the kids in the book are dehumanized by being monsters. But, like, it's a fantasy book. So,
and also, how?
They're not human. They're not supposed to be.
But I feel like that's also incorrect because of who they are.
Yeah.
And how they're portrayed.
I think I saw another creator saying that it's more like othering, which I think is a more accurate representation because the children are specifically different looking.
Yes.
And yes. they have to convince others to love them.
Yeah.
So here's the real controversy. After this book came out, everything was going great. And then TJ Klune opened his big fucking mouth and said during this interview that he took inspiration from the 60s Scoop, which I didn't know anything about, but dove into it a little bit. And the 60s Scoop was when Indigenous children in Canada were taken from their homes forcibly and put in foster care and then placed with white families to assimilate them to white culture.
Mm.
So, bad place to start. And basically, he said that once he heard about the 60s Scoop, he started, like, diving into it and he fell down these, like, rabbit holes and he was researching it and he wanted to write a book about basically how horrible it was, but then he wanted to put a magical spin on it.
Okay.
Or a fantasy spin on it so that it wouldn't be, like, as serious or whatever.
Okay.
Which, like, okay, fine. But then when you start to break down how this book is written mm-hmm. and if you think about not only these kids are being ripped from
yeah.
families that they belonged in,
mm-hmm.
which is not how it's depicted in the book, obviously, but that's how it was in real life. And it kind of gets into this whole story of, like, white saviorism,
yeah.
where, you know, the message that Arthur
mm-hmm.
just kind of came in on his white horse and rescued yeah. these kids and convinced them that where they were was the best place, mm-hmm. and this message that the orphanage is actually this great place and not so bad after all. And I don't agree with that part necessarily, because they do talk about bad orphanages and how awful mm-hmm. they were. So that point doesn't hold that much weight to me. The white saviorism definitely does. Yeah,
I could definitely can see that.
Yeah. And we also don't get that much background about where they actually came from. So if he's saying that he took inspiration from 60 Scoop and we don't get anything to tell us otherwise.
Yeah.
So the point is, first of all, he really should have just kept his mouth shut because no one was connecting these dots till he said it himself.
Well, no, because then it kind of has like a nefarious tone to mm-hmm. it, because it's like, oh, he took it. I could understand him finding this story from that.
Mm-hmm.
And then clearly from what you're saying, it sounds like he was trying to, I don't even like.
It's if he was taking inspiration from this, and then at the end of this story, these kids were returned to their families.
Yeah, it's almost like he took the idea and he was trying to make it better
mm-hmm.
and show like, oh, this is what would happen. This is what could happen if they're put, you know, they were taken from their family or however their situations are. But look at now they're like in a better place.
Yeah. And it's like, and that was obviously not the situation.
Yeah.
It's all of that being said, it's like if all of these allegations about what he meant are true,
yeah,
that is horrible and unfortunate. And I do have a hard time because there are so many problematic authors. And while I don't want them profiting off of others, it's so hard to know what these authors are intending, especially if they're not speaking up.
Yeah, that's the thing. And it's, and I feel like you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, I didn't realize how, I mean, obviously on TikTok, once you discover one thing and then it shows you 100 videos of the same thing, but it just felt like even a lot of creators that I already followed and stuff had videos speaking out about this. And I will share it to our TikTok. There was an Indigenous creator who spoke about this and basically said, you know, I totally appreciate TJ Klune and his representation of the queer community. But that being said, he is profiting off of Indigenous people when it is not his story to tell and not his history to tell.
Well, no, it's just kind of like it's the same story of every white man in America taking something that isn't theirs and profiting off of it. So like it's mm-hmm. it doesn't come as necessarily a surprise, and but like we see this every day.
Mm-hmm.
So it, not that it makes it okay, because it doesn't.
100%.
But like, I mean, what do white men are never going to change. They're mm-hmm. never going to be better. So like this is just what it is, and it sucks that obviously it's like it kind of does taint him and his persona now and mm-hmm. his creativity and what he has done for the queer community and the neurodivergent community. So that like does suck.
Mm-hmm. And you know, there's so many authors, even authors that we've covered on this podcast, even before we knew like Colleen Hoover, before we knew the extent
really
of
deep dive,
you know,
and stuff like that.
And Freda McFadden and stuff. But like we loved their books.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you have this work of art that this creator is putting out into the universe. And so you don't necessarily – it's the same thing. It's like if you buy a painting because you love it so much, but you don't know the background of the painter. So like say like you buy something and you find out like, oh, this woman or man was a criminal, or they mm-hmm. are really shitty people, or their family endorsed slavery. Like, you know what I mean? Then obviously then it completely like taints the thing. So it's like it's very – You're put in a tough position as a reader to try to separate the two,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's like you read something by someone that you really love, and then the story can be very meaningful and impactful for you, and then it's really shitty to find out the person who wrote it wasn't a good person.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important because of this, like, to think about how we consume this media. So you listen to the audiobook. I got my book at a thrift store.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of books that you can borrow from the library. And then that money isn't necessarily going to TJ Klune, but it is supporting our local libraries and it is still reading this story. And I think at the end of the day, we just need to acknowledge that just because you're a part of one marginalized community, aka the queer community, does not give you license to profit off of other marginalized communities.
No, and I feel like this happens so often, like, to be honest. Like, it's just – and I feel like it is more prevalent in, like, those communities where, like, you become – oh, God, there was this one. I'm really upset that I can't think of it. But there's, like, this was, like, this one queer creator who was so, like – because they thought that they were queer and they were doing this, that they were able to speak out and present themselves in other ways. And it's like, okay. And I was like, it's not okay. Like, but you see that all the time.
Mm-hmm. It's like all the fucking white lesbians who voted for Trump.
Yeah.
Like you are you're voting against your own best interests, but because you're white doesn't affect you as much.
Yeah.
So you can just act a fool.
Listen, the world is shitty as it is. And I just want to live in these worlds that I'm reading and not want to learn the other stuff just for like a little bit.
That's the thing. And I'm so torn about it because I do think, especially because we have a podcast and we have a platform, it is our responsibility to look into these
things. Which I agree. And I think that that's really good that you did this. We're not being quiet on it.
Yeah. But then it's like, I also don't think we should have to feel guilty for enjoying the book.
That's how I feel too. Like I, you know, because especially since I read it without knowing the backstory, and it's still a beautiful story. And while the premise of where the story came from isn't necessarily the greatest thing, what he created and this world that he created is very impactful, and it makes people feel seen. So, like, I can't fault it for that.
Yeah, I think that's a good transition to get to our ratings. Our rating scale is, this was hard because I couldn't single out a specific child. I couldn't. So I went with scoops of cherry ice cream.
Oh my God, I was just going to say that. No lie. I was like, if I was doing the rating system, I would have done cherry ice cream.
Oh my gosh. I was like, I wanted to do something from one of the children, but I'm like, I can't pick
one. You can't. No, you can't. Oh my God, that's so funny.
All right, so how many scoops of cherry ice cream did you give this?
4.5.
Okay.
This was really, really good. Actually, I might have even given it a 5. No, I can't remember. But like, regardless, like I loved it. Like it was just, it was such a wholesome, quirky story. And it was so much more than like the main characters. Like it was so much more than Linus and so much more than Arthur. It was, the author did such a good job of making you really care about these children, these, you know, and it's very hard not to like shift your perspective from their point of view and like being different and being put into like the situation where you have to kind of find your own, like who you are without really being with your own family
or being put into a box and having to kind of prove your way out of it.
And it's like, I feel like Arthur's character, and which is why I'm really excited to read the second one, because it's from his like point of view. And so to kind of learn more about Arthur, because I wish I had gotten more about Arthur. So I'm happy like you're going to get that when you read the second book. But like even like him, just I like that it took Linus coming in to unshelter the children and to show them that, okay, there is world out there. And then when they're in that situation where they're in the town and there is kind of like the, you know, the hatred and the disgust from the village people for these children who are different. Like you feel for them and you're just like, you just want to like wring the fucking necks of all like these fucking characters in the book and just be like, this is literally a child. Like the man in the ice cream store, like you're really not going to serve this child. And it's like
we would have just paid for our ice cream and left. Like, why do you suck?
It's like racism and fantasy world. Is like truly what it is. And like, so that was just, you know, it's just disappointing for the kids. And like, you see, like you really feel for them, but so it's just, I don't know. I really liked it. I just thought it was really, it was so creative and I really liked where it went.
Yeah. That's where I kind of get so confused about my feelings because I felt like the depiction of these kids as different the same as it would be, like, these biases, these prejudices, like...
I don't, like, it made me think more. Like, yeah. It put me in a position where I really had to, like, think about, you know, like, if I, like, you know, like, if something was wrong with Millie, like, I wouldn't, especially, like, being a mom, I'm like, if that was one of my kids and, like, we're in a situation where because, oh, my kid looks different or they act different, they don't deserve service, like, that... Mm-hmm. Or they don't deserve to be treated with respect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just fucked.
And this whole kind of mob think where, you know, there's really no basis, but they have this group mentality and this mob mentality. And they don't even know what they're arguing about anymore.
No, because they don't know. They don't know. They're just...
Mm-hmm. They just know in their heads, like, what they think, like, they should know.
Exactly. And I feel like this book... is too relevant to current times, like, without even meaning it to, like, you pick this book, like, not knowing, but, like, honestly, it's like we're in this situation where people just won't fucking listen. Mm-hmm. It's a sheep herd, like, they're just following the herd and without any basis or truth, and they're just gonna go on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, and there's some people that are separating from the herd because now they realize how fucking stupid the herd is. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, you chose this.
Yeah.
And so it's like the same thing. Like, you're choosing to be the herd, fuckers. Yeah. Like, you're choosing to be this way when you don't have to be. Like, you can be your own goddamn person. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be stupid and not educate yourself, then okay, that's fine. You do you. But
yeah, it's kind of, you know, there's all these different levels of being able to read and separate it.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't look into it as much because we didn't know about these other, you know, influences, but we still, when we read, we always are looking for some type of relevance in a social context. Like, I did get this vibe of, you know, how neurodivergent and autistic kids are treated.
Yeah.
And I mean, I rated this 5 scoops of cherry ice cream. I think
I might have given it 5.
I just don't remember it so much. And I have such complicated feelings now because it really does gross me out that he, because it's not like, this is not like it snowballed on TikTok and someone said, oh, I think he's referencing that. He said it out of his mouth or out of his ass, I should say. And he should have just not said anything. So I do feel kind of torn, but I thought the writing was amazing.
Yeah.
I loved the wittiness and the banter and the jokes. And it wasn't just all sarcastic. I feel like a lot of books are like that, where it's all sarcastic and that's the only way to really get the humor across. Mm-hmm. The fact that we couldn't even pick a favorite child just shows multifaceted. And
because even like Theodore, who doesn't speak like, when you get that scene in the book where he allows Linus to look under the couch to look at his hoard, and then you see that this creature, it has feelings because it's not humanized. Like, it has feelings, and it takes tokens of each person in that house and, like, holds it near and dear to them. It reminded me of Marcellus in... Mm-hmm. In
Remarkably
Bright Things, and like how he had his treasure trove. Mm-hmm. And like, this was Theodore's treasure trove, and it was a meaningful treasure trove. Mm-hmm. Like,
it was, and even really... Linus starts to understand his little chirp language. Mm-hmm. And I just thought they were so well thought out. You know, we wanted a little more from some of the characters, obviously, but they just had so many layers to their personalities. And I thought it was so creative. And I really was able to visualize all of these kids. And I loved it. Like, it just filled me with so much joy. And I was just like on a fluffy little cloud the whole time I was reading it.
I agree.
And, you know, obviously I love a little queer love story that's not over the top.
No.
And the setting was great. I'm definitely excited for the sequel.
Me too.
And we'll keep an eye on TJ Klune.
Yeah.
We're giving him a semi pass. He's already a male, so like
I'm like, what can you do? Like, I don't know.
Like, we already knew he was going to be problematic. He's a male author.
He's a white male.
He's a white male. So we're doing our best. If you have comments, opinions, please let us know. I want to know other people's opinions on this, because I do feel like maybe we are letting him off easy because we liked the book. That's a big possibility. But also, like I said, you look something up on TikTok and all of a sudden,
yeah,
you're ready to get the pitchforks out, you know? That's another mob mentality.
That's the cancel culture of social media. Yeah. And yeah. That's just, you know.
Exactly. So, and you know, I think that all he really had to do was apologize and maybe not write a sequel. But listen, he's getting that bag, and I can't act like I would be any different. I would apologize, though. Let's be real about that.
Yeah.
All right. So that's all we have for you today. And it was a lot. If you like what you heard, please make sure to follow, subscribe, and rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use. If you have any book recommendations or questions for us, you can email us at fullybookedcalfpod@gmail.com. Also, be sure to follow us on TikTok and Instagram at fullybookedcalfpod to see our upcoming reads. Thanks for checking us out. And remember,
if you need us, we're fully booked.
Bye.